welcome to Religion in the News. This is Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service. Over the next 30 minutes, we'll be featuring articles from the Washington Post, from the Associated Press, from The Week magazine, and more. This program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. And we begin this week's episode of Religion in the News with an article from the Washington Post dated August 21st. This is entitled, Christian Colleges Take Steps to Address Racial Justice After Criticism. And this article was written by Catherine Post and Adele M. Banks of the Washington Post. After the killing of George Floyd in police custody, George Fox University, a Quaker-founded evangelical Christian school in Oregon, announced plans to change its campus culture, improve police engagement, and diversify its board of trustees. Gordon College, a Christian institution in Massachusetts, said it would consider adding a Black History course to its core curriculum. Calvin University in Michigan offered a summer class, Faithful Anti-Racism in a Time of Pandemic. They were among the dozens of evangelical colleges and universities that issued statements grieving Floyd's death and pledging to find practical steps to address racial justice on and beyond their campuses. But the school's promises to correct an often common history of failing to prioritize racial justice and reconciliation left some students unsatisfied. "You failed me and so many other Black students," a George Fox graduate commented on a Facebook post from the university. "Do better than just putting words on Facebook. You fail to support students of color in and out of the classroom. Your retention rates for students of color are lower because y'all don't know how to hire a diverse faculty who are able to connect with the students," another commented. Students and staff at Calvin University were also vocal about their desire for a more decisive response from leadership. Two Black staff members who were then advisors to Calvin's sister-to-sister affinity group for Black women wrote a May 30th open letter to the university's administration. "Your Black students are tired, angry, and hurting. Your students of color are tired, are angry, and hurting," said Michelle Gwynyard and Rachel Hamilton. "Your staff, faculty, and alum of color are tired, angry, and hurting. We don't need silence right now. We want to know that when we say that we are devoted to diversity and inclusion, that includes justice and speaking against injustice." Race relations experts say they have been trying for years to move these often predominantly white institutions to be not just diverse in student body and their faculty and other hires, but truly inclusive. The deep national response to Floyd's death has now put pressure on some of these institutions to go beyond promised prayers and panel discussions. Shirley Hoekstra, president of the Council for Christian Colleges and Universities, said she doesn't think racial justice efforts are any more challenging in Christian higher education than in white-majority education. But she said the leaders of the 140 U.S. schools in her consortium are seeking to find ways to foster appropriate relations on their campuses. The effort is driven not only by this summer's protests, but by broader demographic changes. The Black student population at CCCU-related institutions has grown, according to U.S. Education Department data, from 9.73% of all students in the 2007-2008 school year to 10.8% in 2018-2019. Hispanic students increased from 5.3% to 11.3% in the same time period. Leaders of Christian colleges and universities still need to work on providing minority students with a college experience where they are not regarded wrongly and even unconsciously as outliers in an environment primarily catering to white people, Hoekstra said. "I would say the challenge is to be able to have self-reflection and self-assessment as to how you then become a school that no longer has students who are guests and hosts," she said, citing advice from Rebecca Hernandez, chief diversity officer at George Fox University, and other leaders of color in the CCCU community. After the pushback to its initial statement, George Fox released a more explicit statement on June 18th that read in part, "Black lives absolutely matter to Christ, and Black lives absolutely matter to George Fox University. The university has been at this work for many years, and we acknowledge we've had failures alongside our successes," the statement read. "Work we said was a priority was not always treated as such. As a community, we own that. We must do better." As part of the changes, George Fox will train its campus security in de-escalation tactics, develop student learning goals to address diversity and inclusion through a pilot program in spring 2021, and hire an admissions staffer focused on building relationships with diverse student populations. These initiatives are part of a long-term commitment of the university, Hernandez says. It comes out of our Quaker roots. Quakers have historically been very involved in peace and justice efforts. Hernandez, who has been at George Fox for almost 7 years, said the university has been prioritizing recruitment and retention of faculty and staff of color for as long as she's been there, which has resulted in a faculty that is 18% people of color. She noted George Fox still has a ways to go until the faculty is representative of the student body, which is 32% students of color. At Gordon College, student leaders chose not to settle into summer break, but instead to demand their school get to work after Floyd's death. Our student government brought to our attention that while this may be summer, this is a crisis situation, said Nick Rowe, Associate Vice President for Student and Global Engagement. They said our students are suffering and are really frustrated because it feels like the school they go to isn't equipping them to respond to what happened. The student government, in collaboration with Black-led student groups, proposed making curriculum changes that would highlight Black experiences within the coursework. Gordon says it is taking that proposal seriously. In a June 12 Facebook post, Gordon stated, "We know we can do better, and we are sorry for the hurt and harm that our Black community has endured through their Gordon experience. We are committed to listening well so that we can act well." Though curriculum changes aren't final, Gordon wants to build consensus to avoid a quick fix, according to Executive Vice President for Academic Affairs Sandy Dineski. Rose said the changes will include the addition of a Black history course to the core curriculum. The change comes amid an identity shift for the institution, whose student body has seen an increase from 20% students of color in 2016 to almost one-third students of color in 2020, according to Rowe. That diversity has not been reflected in the faculty and staff, who have grappled with what Rowe called white normativity in the classroom. At Calvin University, the day after Gwynyard and Hamilton issued their open letter, the school's president released a statement acknowledging the pain of Black and brown members of our community and expressed the school's commitment to anti-racism, anti-violence, and the vision of God's shalom for the human community. "We have some amazing students, and I think they're good at holding our feet to the fire," said Penny Lynn Dykstra-Pruim, Calvin's Associate Dean for Diversity and Inclusion. "They let us know when we're being slow." Recently, Calvin redesigned Dykstra-Pruim's position to prioritize diversity and inclusion in both faculty training and in curriculum development, especially as Calvin works to revamp its core curriculum. As part of her reconfigured position, Dykstra-Pruim has been working to help faculty and staff draft statements of diversity and inclusion to include on their syllabi. All faculty will be asked to include these statements in the fall. No less self-examination is going on at Christian seminaries, where students and some professors have also called for greater inclusion and racial justice. After Black leaders at dozens of theological schools and religion departments released a statement in early June, scores of white deans and presidents at institutions belonging to the Association of Theological Schools followed, with a letter pledging solidarity with their colleagues of color and a focus on unlearning white supremacy and reimagining theological education. Allie Henney, who helped organize a 2018 hashtag Toxic Fuller protest while a graduate student at Fuller Theological Seminary in Los Angeles, said she was pleased to hear her alma mater's president and four associate deans sign the letter. But Henney said she will reserve her congratulations until she sees substantive change. Henney said some professors at Fuller, which in 2019-2020 had about 8% Black and 5.8% Hispanic students, were intentional about including Black and Hispanic authors on their reading lists. Others tended to pick only 1 week of a course to focus on writings of scholars who were not white men. "Fuller is what I would call nice white folks," said Henney, a writer and podcaster who was a member of the school's Black Seminarians Council until her June graduation. "They understand how to present themselves in the space as if they're listening, but whenever you get to action points and you get to the rubber actually meeting the road, Fuller suffers from what a lot of institutions suffer from, and that's inertia." Alexis Abernethy, who was hired as Fuller's Associate Provost for Faculty Inclusion and Equity just before the 2018 protest, said she understands Henney's concerns and is aware some faculty still need to make a more concerted effort to put together inclusive syllabi. "But structural changes have begun," Abernethy said. Fuller's faculty now have to report progress on diversifying their courses in their annual reports to their deans. The school is also pushing for a deeper integration of Black and Latino authors in the upcoming academic year, so professors include their perspectives more often across a quarter. I do get that for our students, some of our students, it's not felt fast enough, Abernathy said. I do have to say for some of our other students, they feel the difference. Brenda Salter McNeil, an associate professor of reconciliation studies at Seattle Pacific University, has been an advocate for making race relations a priority at Christian seminaries and colleges alike. In 2019, she led a discussion, Diversity is Discipleship, at the third CCCU Diversity Conference. Salter McNeil said she hopes religious institutions of higher learning will start doing real reparative work along the lines of Georgetown University's initiatives to address its historical ties to slavery. But she said she feels exhausted by trying to motivate schools to address race. The CCCU has so hurt and disappointed so many of us who have worked for years to try to be patient enough and collaborative enough and in dialogue enough with this issue that many of us have given up, Salter McNeil said. I have given up. Hoekstra said it was heartbreaking to hear that assessment. When an outstanding leader like Brenda Salter McNeil has said, I've given up, it just tells you the weight of the burden, she said. As a white leader with a position of influence, I am committed to making sure that that doesn't happen for our next generation of leaders. We'll turn next to an article from the Associated Press dated August 27th, and this is entitled, Latin America's Evangelical Churches Hit Hard by Pandemic. This is Dateline Managua, Nicaragua. Some 400 men and women spaced themselves across a sprawling worship hall, praying through face masks with arms raised for the health of friends and family suffering from the coronavirus. The congregation of Managua's Bethel Restoration Church knew the pandemic's wrath. Two of its pastors were among the more than 40 evangelical leaders who have died in Nicaragua since March. Throughout Latin America, a traditionally Catholic region with a surging evangelical presence in nearly every country, evangelical churches have kept spreading the gospel despite government measures meant to slow the spread of the coronavirus. In many countries, evangelical churches have flouted public health guidelines by holding in-person services, or have personally ministered to church members in homes and other settings. In at least two countries, evangelical pastors have died in alarming numbers during the pandemic. In Bolivia, where some 100 evangelical pastors have died, they've maintained close contact with their congregations, ministering and providing support to the sick even though churches were closed early by government decree. In Nicaragua, where the government has played down the epidemic and avoided imposing restrictions, evangelical services continued at some churches, even as the more hierarchical Roman Catholic churches stopped holding in-person mass. There was too much misinformation, said Raul Valadares, who took over Bethel's congregation after his father and another pastor died June 5th. Just in our denomination, some 20 pastors have died. And at Bethel, we have a pastor, my father, and some 25 brothers, or members, who died from COVID-19, though he said the church had tracked the cases and didn't believe they stemmed from services. In Brazil, the Catholic Bishops' Conference halted masses and indoor celebrations after the pandemic hit the country in mid-March, but most evangelicals kept holding services. Authorities began relaxing restrictions in June, and some Catholic churches reopened with extra precautions. Meanwhile, some evangelical leaders in Brazil have advocated for miraculous cures or called the disease a plague that kills those of little faith and vowed to continue services. They have been strongly backed by President Jair Bolsonaro, who counts many evangelicals among his most fervent supporters. The president declared back in March that religious activities were essential during the pandemic, allowing churches to open and religious workers to move around. But some states have enforced their own restrictions. Beto Marubo, an indigenous leader in the Javari Valley, a remote region of Brazil bordering Peru, said active services have created risks for his people. Some have attended evangelical services in the city of Atalaya do Norte and then brought the virus to our lands, he said. Long after the virus appeared in Nicaragua in March, the government of President Daniel Ortega continued holding and promoting mass events. Schools remained open, the baseball season continued. Ortega, like Bolsonaro, said the country couldn't afford to stop working. In Nicaragua, evangelical churches, large and small, stayed open too, at least at first. Bethel stayed open until the Assemblies of God Nicaragua Conference, to which Bethel belongs, told the majority of its churches to close immediately, May 12th until June 1st, due to the pandemic spread. After June 1st, church leaders were allowed to decide when to reopen. Ovidio Valladares, the family patriarch and director of Bethel's radio restoration, was hospitalized May 26th and never recovered. Bethel remained closed until August 2nd, when it reopened with masks required, hand sanitizer at the entrances, and spacing between chairs in a large worship hall, holding a fraction of its previous capacity of 1,500. According to the Nicaraguan Evangelical Alliance, which includes most of the more than 100 Christian denominations in the country, at least 44 pastors have died since March. Not all of those deaths were confirmed as COVID-19 because of a lack of testing. Evangelical pastors in Bolivia tried to keep in contact with parishioners, even though churches in most parts of the country remain closed. They went to pray to visit the sick. In that work, they died, said Pastor Luis Arequipa of the National Christian Council, who said that more than 100 evangelical pastors have died in the pandemic. Among them was the Reverend Roberto Arismendi, founder of the Evangelical Churches of Bolivia. The 79-year-old Aymara pastor died July 20th from complications related to COVID-19, said his son, Javier Arismendi. My father never stopped helping people. He was always close to his congregation, giving them faith but also food and peace, said the younger Arismendi, who has taken over the church since his father's death. We don't know in what moment he got infected, but he brought the virus to the whole family. 8 family members fell ill, but all recovered. The church, in a working-class La Paz neighborhood, saw its congregation hit hard. 30% of our congregation of almost 100 people were affected, he said. Overall, the country of about 11.5 million people has seen more than 108,000 reported infections and nearly 5,000 government-confirmed deaths. Back in Nicaragua, many evangelical churches have reopened, some with health precautions, like Bethel, where congregants are asked to bring their own hand sanitizer. The measures were recommended by the senior Valladares before he died. But other churches carry on as normal. At the Oasis of Peace Church in Masaya, south of the capital, about 70 congregants without masks packed together under an open-sided pavilion, singing and shouting while a Christian rock band played behind the pastor. There was a thermos of water at the entrance for hand washing, but no one appeared to use it. We're living in difficult times, times in which not only our country is being lashed, but on a global level, said worshiper Minor Campos. It is time to seek the presence of God. Our next article comes from the August 23rd edition of The Week magazine, and it's entitled China's War on Religion. And it's a question and answer column written by the staff of the magazine. And the subheadline, to secure its hold on power, the Communist Party is tightening its control over all faiths in China. Here's everything you need to know. When did the crackdown begin? Religious repression has intensified across China since President Xi Jinping took office in 2013. The brutal crackdown on minority Muslims in the northwestern region of Xinjiang, where mosques and madrasas are being demolished and more than 1 million Uyghurs have been detained in re-education camps, has sparked international outrage. But the Communist Party's assault on faith is not limited to Islam. Authorities have used the world's distraction over the coronavirus pandemic to accelerate an ongoing campaign against Christianity. Officially atheist, the party sees adherence to any faith, particularly those with foreign origins such as Christianity and Islam, as a threat to its dominance. So Xi has embarked on the sinicization of religious practice, ordering Muslim, Buddhist, and Christian leaders to integrate Chinese communist thought into their belief systems. The party wants people to love the motherland and their faith, says Yu Quan, head of the body that oversees ethnic and religious affairs in China. Sinicization has resulted in thousands of churches and mosques being shuttered and razed. Those that remain fly Chinese flags. How is Christianity practiced in China? For decades, Chinese Catholics and Protestants have been divided between those who attend state-sanctioned churches, in which clerics are appointed by Beijing, and those who attend so-called underground churches. About half of China's 12 million Catholics worship in the underground churches loyal to the Vatican. To try to heal that schism, Beijing and the Vatican struck a deal in 2018 that gives Chinese authorities the right to recommend new bishops and the Pope the power to approve or veto them. Beijing has exploited that agreement by refusing to name bishops to half of China's 98 dioceses, while pressuring priests to adhere to party regulations, saying that the Vatican Pact means that the Pope commands them to do so. Portraits of the Virgin Mary have been replaced by portraits of Xi, and priests have been compelled to incorporate Xi's sayings into their sermons. What about Protestant churches? Protestantism is China's fastest-growing religion, and so is especially worrisome to Xi. The state registered church, the Three Self Patriotic Movement, claimed some 39 million adherents. But at least another 40 million are thought to worship in underground home churches, pushing the share of Chinese who are Protestants to nearly 6%, about the same as the membership of the Communist Party. Beijing is determined to control the faith. Online bookstores have been banned from selling Bibles as authorities prepare a new Mandarin translation that some fear will omit whole chapters. Pastors have been ordered to attend government-sponsored training sessions where they are told that in China the state leads and church follows. Thousands of underground churches have been closed. At those that remain open, symbols of faith have been purged, with crosses and Bibles burned. Facial recognition cameras have been installed so that authorities can track and harass worshippers, a tactic pioneered against Buddhists in the autonomous Chinese province of Tibet. What happened in Tibet? Tibetan Buddhism has been targeted by Beijing for decades because it is a central pillar of Tibetan identity. That repression is ramped up under Xi. Tens of thousands of party members have been deployed to temples and villages under an outreach initiative that doubles as a surveillance program. And since 2016, up to 17,000 Buddhist monks and nuns have been evicted from two key training institutes and sent to indoctrination centers, where the U.S. State Department reports they were beaten and shocked with electric batons. Chen Kuangguo, the Politburo member who oversaw the Tibet crackdown, was sent to Xinjiang in 2016 to use the same playbook against Uyghur Muslims. Detainees are forced to say, "There is no God, there is only the Communist Party," said Omer Kanat, head of the U.S.-based Uyghur Human Rights Project. Are other religious groups being repressed? The Hui, a Muslim minority of some 10 million people in central China, are now suffering the same fate as the Uyghurs. Their mosques are being cynicized, stripped of domes and minarets, and the call to prayer has been banned. Many Hui fear that concentration camps may come next. The only faith that remains relatively free is Chinese Buddhism, which is seen as indigenous. Still, it too is being pressed into party service. In 2018, the Shaolin Monastery, birthplace of Kung Fu, was forced to fly the Chinese national flag for the first time in its 1,500-year industry. How has the U.S. responded? The Trump administration has sanctioned dozens of companies and governmental bodies connected to human rights abuses in Xinjiang. And last month, Chen and three other top officials were hit with sanctions under the Global Magnitsky Act, freezing their U.S. assets and banning American companies from doing business with them. "The U.S. will not stand by," said Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, as the Communist Party attempts to eradicate Uyghurs' culture and Muslim faith. But outside pressure is unlikely to alter Chinese policy, says Carrie Kosel, an expert on religion in China. The state, she says, sees religion as an existential threat. Eradicating Falun Gong. The Chinese government has identified five poisons that threaten its rule: pro-democracy activists, Taiwanese nationalists, Tibetan dissidents, Uyghur separatists, and Falun Gong, a spiritual discipline that mixes traditional Qigong with New Age philosophy. Founded in northeast China in 1992 by former trumpet player Li Xiangji, Falun Gong, or Law Wheel Practice, promises salvation to those who study Master Li's texts and practice a regimen of gentle physical movements. Li attracted some 70 million followers in a matter of years, a level of popularity that worried the Communist Party. It banned Falun Gong in 1999, labeling the movement an evil cult and arresting tens of thousands of adherents. Human rights activists say thousands were killed and had their organs harvested for transplant. Falun Gong practitioners who fled to Hong Kong, where they could practice freely, fear a sweeping new security law imposed on the city by Beijing now could be wielded against them. "It is a hanging knife over our heads," said Ingrid Wu, a Falun Gong spokeswoman. We'll wrap up this week on religion in the news with an article from the Washington Post dated August 24th. And this is an opinion piece entitled, "One Nation Under God? More and More Americans Don't Think So." And this is by Charles Lane of the Washington Post editorial editorial staff. In the United States, one of the most consequential cultural changes of our time may be the swift and seemingly accelerating decline of religious commitment. Historically, Americans have recorded relatively high levels of worship service attendance and belief in God as compared with their peers in advanced industrial societies such as Europe or Japan. The U.S. example seemed to show that faith could survive in an environment dominated by science and technology. A forthcoming book by University of Michigan political scientist Ronald F. Engelhardt, however, suggests that the United States is now rapidly catching up with the trend towards secularization elsewhere. When asked to express the importance of God in their lives on a scale of 1 to 10, with 1 being not at all important and 10 being very important, Americans rated him at an average of 4.6 in 2017, down from 8.2 in just over a decade, according to an excerpt of Engelhardt's book, Religion's Sudden Decline in the Current Issue of Foreign Affairs. A major source of this country's relative social and political conservatism is essentially disappearing, with potentially far-reaching implications for everything from criminal justice to education to foreign policy. Increasingly, the two political parties are not characterized by their respective predominant religious groups, but by whether their adherents belong to any religion at all. 38% of Democrats say they regularly attend services. For Republicans, the figure is 54%. The U.S. importance of God score started higher than others and had more room to fall. Still, Engelhardt's finding reinforces those the Pew Research Center published last October, showing that the share of Americans claiming none as their religious affiliation had grown from 16% to 26% since 2007. Fewer than half of Americans now attend services regularly, with only 35% of millennials going at least once a month. Why the dramatic change in only a decade? Engelhardt portrays the U.S. shift as part of a global trend also perceptible in 43 of the 49 countries that he studied, containing 60% of the world's population. Social and economic development renders human survival less precarious, human suffering less dramatic, and human beings less needful of existential comfort or guidance from age-old traditions. Engelhardt notes that religions generally revolve around beliefs and rules about sex, gender roles, and family that are closely linked to the imperative of maintaining high birth rates. In modern societies that have mostly conquered infant mortality while extending life expectancy, that imperative loses relevance. The decline of traditional religion is thus an indirect but foreseeable result of demographic transition and may spread to less developed countries as they modernize. Engelhardt's argument fits some cases better than others. Religious commitment has increased since 2007 in India, according to his data. During this time, India was one of the fastest-growing economies in the world. Its infant mortality rate declined by nearly half. Engelhardt ascribes this anomaly to the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party's promotion of Hinduism-based nationalism and Indian Muslims' counter-assertion, but an exception that encompasses 17.5% of the world's population is large indeed. Meanwhile, his data suggests that religious feeling also has been waning in China, where 18% of the world lives. There, too, government policy is a confounding variable. China's systematic repression of Islam, Tibetan Buddhism, Christianity, and Falun Gong probably results in less adherence to religious faith and more reluctance to admit it in surveys. Engelhardt acknowledged this in an email reply to my question. Engelhardt's hypothesis works best for countries such as the United States, where government does not manipulate choices on religious affiliation. A possible additional influence is social media, whose arrival as a mass cultural phenomenon coincides with the onset of religion's decline in 2007. Religious institutions make use of social media themselves, to be sure. But social media enables people to establish communities, make friends, and meet romantic partners without the aid of a church or other religious gathering place. It offers near infinite distracting alternatives to religious study. Engelhardt suggests that traditional religion could have a comeback if the pandemic and associated hardships lead people to rediscover solace from God. For the time being, however, the intense moral passion our ancestors in America once channeled into disputes among existing religions is finding a different outlet, politics. That's it for our time this week on Religion in the News. We'll talk to you again next week. I'm Brian LeBlanc for the North Carolina Reading Service, and we will talk to you next time on Religion in the News.